This is Kelly Krager of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Alfred Alvarez. Today is the 3rd of June, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Alvarez is kind enough to join us from his home in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Mr. Alvarez.
Good morning, sir.
I'd like to thank you once again for participating in the oral history project with us here today. Let's go ahead and get started with some basic background information. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
Right. I was born here in San Antonio, Texas on June 11th, 1948. So next week I'll be hitting the big 6-0.
Big 6-0. I noticed that in your file. Your birthday was June 11th, so you had one coming up.
Right. And I grew up here in San Antonio, up here in the south central part of town called the Hardindale area. And grew up in a basic working middle class family area, so had a nice experience with the elementary schools and the neighborhood kids. And being a baby boomer, there were many other baby boomers, and luckily where our house was at, just almost right next door, there was a park, and that's where we used to play at. You know, we used to play baseball and football and fly model airplanes and fly kites. So grew up almost in a idealistic type of neighborhood with a little neighborhood store almost across the street, you know, a mom and pop store. So, you know, it seemed that it was an idealistic type of setting to grow up in.
That sounds terrific. What were your parents' names, your mother and father?
My parents' name?
Yes.
Okay, my parents' name, my father is Alfredo E. Alvarez, and my mother, Pandidia Gomez Alvarez. My father, he's a World War II vet, served in the 24th Infantry, and after the war, you know, he started working with Federal Civil Service and started out working at Fort Sam Houston, but eventually transferred over to Randolph Air Force Base, where he stayed at for some 20-odd years. And my mother was a regular homemaker, which was traditional back then of that time period. All right.
Where did you go to school?
Okay. I went to Morrow Elementary, and then went over to Hardindale Junior High, and eventually went to Hardindale High School, which I graduated in 1966. So, like I said, we live in the central part of South part of San Antonio, which is the Hardindale School District, which at one time Hardindale was a little cow town and was eventually absorbed into San Antonio back in 1946.
That's some of that World War II growth for you in San Antonio, I guess, huh?
That's right.
Yes. Well, you already mentioned your almost idyllic childhood growing up there in that neighborhood. Lots of friends, lots of family around. What were you, in high school, what were your major areas of interest?
My major interest was in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I still am a history buff, and it seemed that it's primarily history that got me going into the military almost right after high school, because I was in high school. Well, I remember when I was in junior high, I believe I was eighth grader when we had that missile crisis there in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in high school, it seemed that the Vietnam War started off with that Gulf of Tonkin, and I was just a junior, and I should say a sophomore, and then later on when I was a junior, that's when we got into that's when we first sent our ground troops on in. So when I was a senior up in high school, you know, I used to see all of the newspapers, and I was interested in the wars because, like I said, I was a history buff. And that's what kind of encouraged me to go ahead and join the military right after high school, because looking at our wars, I was afraid that instead of going to college for 4 years right after high school, that the war might be over, because I was looking like at the First World War, and we entered that war, and we finished it up within a year and a half. And then the Second War, you know, that ended just right short of 4 years, and Korea was only 3 years, so I was afraid that if I waited till after college that this Vietnam War might be over, so I volunteered almost immediately after high school graduation. And I went into Army Aviation because when I was in high school, I discovered the cadet program of the Civil Air Patrol. The Civil Air Patrol is the Air Force Auxiliary, and they had a cadet program. And so I joined that organization and became involved with military aviation and also military training, which is based upon the Air Force, since that's the Air Force Auxiliary. So that kind of encouraged me to go ahead and join the Army right after high school. And I chose Army Aviation because all of the other branches, like the Air Force, Marines, and Navy, they required a pilot to be a college graduate to become a pilot. The Army was the only one which you could be a high school graduate and be a pilot, you know, provided that you pass the written exams and your flight physicals and all that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I went ahead and decided to go ahead and join into Army Aviation. And I signed up for it originally by, they had what they call the WOC program, the Warrant Officer Candidate Program.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated from high school on June the 2nd of 1966, turned 18 on June 11th, and I decided to go ahead and join the Army on June the 21st. And I would have to, but seeing that my flight physical, my right, I should say my left eye was a little bit weak. I was not 20/20, I was like 20 and 19.9. So, seeing that I could sign up to be an enlisted air crewman, and this was for your Hueys, your UH-1 Hueys, because that's the one which I was seeing in the papers, and that's what I wanted to do. And so that's why I enlisted in the Army right after high school and after I turned 18, because I knew that my parents would not sign up for me since they wanted for me to go into college.
Sure.
That's why I went into the Army almost right away after high school.
Well, very good. Let me back up here a little bit.
Sure.
It sounds like you were very aware as a young man, both in high school and shortly after, of world affairs and America's role in world affairs.
Yes.
If you can, give me your thoughts as a 17, 18-year-old young man in San Antonio on the United States' role, one, in the world, in the Cold War at this stage, and more specifically, too, its policies, its approach to Vietnam.
All right. It seemed that the United States' role was, you know, the United States always meant freedom, meant liberty,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed that our military forces, you know, like in Korea, and it seemed eventually Vietnam, it was a policy of containment, containing the communist forces to a certain areas instead of letting them just overcome any countries, at least with the United States stepping in like we did earlier in Korea. We were doing the same thing there like in Vietnam, to keeping the military communist forces on out and trying to establish a democracy of freedom and a more liberal type of society for those countries that we were defending. We did a very good policy there in Korea, maybe because Korea is a peninsula surrounded by water and only just facing North Korea on their northern border, so maybe we had a better effect on making a very great freedom country out of that area. But with Vietnam, since that was on the coast, it was much more difficult. So that's why it was very, very, very important that we had to stand and defend the Soviet-Vietnamese government, because I think that, if I remember correctly, that South Vietnam, just like us, and we were a part of that CEDO organization. You know, like we always heard of NATO for there in Europe, there in the South Pacific, South Asia, you know, we had CEDO, which we had countries like ourselves, Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, South Korea, and of course in South Vietnam, which we were all parts of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people forget, sure, the United States, you know, provided the main military bulk for defending South Vietnam, but we also had Australian military forces. We had at least two South Korean divisions there. I believe the Thailand, well, we had the Air Force bases there. The Philippines, they provided some medical units. So I think that our involvement in South Vietnam was I fully concur with our beliefs and what we were doing there.
So it sounds like you were very much aware of the larger picture of U.S. strategy, U.S. role in the world, and Vietnam's place in that. Well, that was your opinion. Young Alfred had that opinion. What
right.
about your parents? What was their reaction when you told them that you were going to enlist in the Army?
Okay. Well, my father did not want for me to do that. He did not think that war was right and that we should, you know, keep out of that war. And so I knew that he would not let me enlist in the Army, before I was 18. So I had to do it after I was 18, to do my own free will. My mother, she hated to see me go into the Army, but she came from a military family, and seeing that her brothers, one which was killed, and all of her brothers were wounded during the Second War, could see that, I guess I must have inherited the military genes, which I was just carrying on. So she let me do what I wanted to do and gave me her blessings.
Now, you mentioned your father's opposition to this war. Was your father's opposition to the war, was it political in his opposition, or was it more strategic, meaning that was it something that he believed was being politically driven, or was his opposition to the war based on the circumstances on the ground, the circumstances of America's national interest? What was the basis of his opposition to the war?
Yeah, I think that the basis of his opposition was more political.
Mm-hmm.
He must have had thoughts about Korea, how we were there, we fought that war for 3 years, lost so many troopers, but the enemy was still there on the northern side. So he must have believed that fighting there in Vietnam was going to be the same thing, that many American lives would be lost, but nothing would be really gained. I guess him being a World War II vet, with the World War II veterans, they came and they took out Hitler and they took out Tojo and got rid of Mussolini, and that was more of a clear-cut winning situation. But with Korea and with Vietnam, I guess he must figure that, if it was a no-win type of situation, then we should just not become involved and use American lives.
Sure, sure. Now, your father served, and you mentioned you have a tradition of military service in your family, so is it safe to assume that your father was not opposed to your joining the military, but opposed to your joining the military knowing that you would be sent to Vietnam?
Right.
Okay. So you enlist against probably the wishes of your father, although it sounds like both of your parents were very supportive in what you chose to do. You go to boot camp. Where was boot camp for you?
Okay, boot camp, basic training was at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And it seemed that I found out that a few weeks after I joined the Army that some of my friends, they joined up the Army also because they wanted to be in the same training cycle that I was.
Oh, that's nice.
But unfortunately, they wound up in different units, and so had to my unit would compete against them. But basic training, I believe, to me, was the most, horrible part of Army life, because that's probably because when you're 18 and always have lived at home, lived with your parents, you always had someone there for your side. But for the first time, I was hundreds of miles away at home, and I had this one sergeant screaming and yelling in your face. So if it was a horrible experience, but I kept my cool because I knew that it was just a training cycle in which I told myself that, they're just trying to expose us, so in case that we ever got caught by the military enemy, that's what they would try to harass us that way.
Sure. What was a daily? What was your daily routine? What was an average day, if there is such a thing in boot camp? Can you describe that for me briefly?
Right. Okay. What it would be. Every time that we would go off before breakfast, the first half we would run 1 mile before breakfast. The second half of training, we'd run 2 miles before breakfast. And before you entered the mess hall, either for breakfast, lunch, or supper, they had a chin-up bar, so you had to do 3 chin-ups. And if you couldn't complete those 3 chin-ups, you know, especially at the beginning, but then you had to do 20 push-ups once you hit the ground. And then after breakfast, we marched out in detail, the formation, and it would be about 1 hour of bayonet training, another hour of hand-to-hand combat, then down to the gun range where, at that time, we used the M14 rifle. We would go on down and fire up our weapons, and then we would go on out to learn evasive type of maneuvers on out in the boonies, and sometimes we would just take a break by having an hour off PT, and then just marching on back to the unit. So it was like that almost every day, and then there was some more advanced training, especially toward the latter half, where we would be not only firing our weapons at the gun range, but also going up and down the hills and shooting at pop-up targets. And at that time, we had moved out of the barracks and we were living in pup tents. And of course, there was also the basic training on marching informations and manual of arms with our weapons, you know, like left shoulder, right shoulder, port arms, and all this other stuff. And then marching on back. So it was just learning to be basically an infantry soldier. That's what Army basic training was all about.
Sure. Were there any moments that stand out to you, any incidents through a basic training that stand out to you more than any others?
The standout basic, all I could think of is like what we would call the, the type of basic training, forget that type of movement, where we would crawl under barbed wire and there would be live ammunition being fired above us. And we would do that at daytime and at nighttime. And then I guess that was trying to get us troopers conditioned to hearing machine gun bullets and seeing the tracers fly just right over our heads and while we're crawling on our backs, and also negotiating tree trunks and barbed wire. So, but I found that the most challenging part, other than one part of the confidence course, which you climb up this pine tree, really 2 pine trees, and then there's a large rope which you have to jump on it and then crawl all the way down. And that was a big drop of about 60 or 70 feet. And so that's why you always hang on to that rope and just crawl on down that rope. So that was it for basic training, yeah.
Where did you go for advanced training?
Okay, advanced training. Okay, that was at Fort Eustis, Virginia. And like I said, I had signed up for your Huey ground school. And it seemed that when I got there to Fort Eustis, Virginia, seemed that I was involved in a night school. And I found out that in Army Aviation, since the Vietnam War, it seemed that the helicopters, Army Aviation helicopters, were playing a great role overseas, that the school for your enlisted crewmen were only at 2 places, Fort Eustis, Virginia, and Fort Rucker, Alabama. Your pilot training was at Fort Rucker, Alabama, and at Camp Walters, Texas. But being an enlisted man, like I said, I'm out there for uses, and it was a night school. It seemed that they were training us air crewmen around the clock, I guess you could say. They had the normal classes, you know, regular classes during the daytime, but seemed that I wound up in a night class where we would start classes around 7 o'clock in the evening, and they would last until about, well, we would take a supper break around 11 o'clock at night, and then finish up about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, in the ground school where we were knowing all of the mechanical details of the Huey helicopter, all of the nuts and bolts and engine parts and transmission parts and electrical parts and the metal fabric of the aircraft. And so that's what it was for the night school. And then the last 2 weeks of that school became a day school, because that's when we actually flew on with the aircraft, and we also had some machine gun training on it, you know, with being a machine gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember that right before we started the night school or the day school, it seemed that we, well, like they always told us in the Army, that no matter what your MOS is, your secondary MOS will always be infantry. So when we first got there to Fort Eustis, Virginia, before we started school, we were issued out M14s, and we went out to the field, and there they had a simulated Vietnam village, which, and you know, they trained us that when we go through the jungle, to always look like for your booby traps, or for your little barbed spikes that they had,
mm-hmm.
and, I don't know, and the ground and other stuff. And they had some GIs, some acting like your VCs, which, and they were hidden in the trees and bushes, and they would be telling us to always be aware of these type of enemy where they would be hiding at. And so about that part, you know, was very interesting part. So what we did as infantry part first, well, before we actually started working on the helicopters. And I liked Fort Eustis, Virginia, because unlike Fort Polk, which was very hot and humid, like during the months of June, July, and August,
mm-hmm.
there, I was stationed at Fort Polk there from September all the way through March. And that was the first time that I encountered snow, like during the winter time, had to even shovel snow. Seeing pine trees, unlike here in Texas, where we have a lot of mesquite trees, that was that part, there was a lot of pine trees. But I like Fort Eustis because there I felt like a student, and we would march to classes and march to lunch, and to me I felt more like a student.
I would definitely say that you were in Fort Polk, Louisiana during the wrong time of the year, for
that's
sure.
Right.
What did you hope to do as part of an air crew member?
Okay, what I wanted to do was, since I was not going to be a pilot, I wanted to be a crew chief, and a
mm-hmm.
crew chief on Huey was a gunner,
mm-hmm.
and so, and of course, the crew chief, his main job is to keep that aircraft flying, to be sure that, you know, all the parts and pieces all have nuts and bolts and are screwed on right, and are have safety wiring done right, and all the oil, hydraulic levels, and electrical lines are right. So you had a big responsibility of keeping the aircraft flyable, because not only are you flying in it, but you have the air crew flying in it, and also you have all the other passengers, the other troopers that you'll be humping into the battle scene. So this was a big responsibility, which I, as an 18-year-old, was accepting. And another thing which I like about Fort Eustis, Virginia, because that was located in the Tidewater area, and there they had at the service club, they had a bus that would go out on tours to some of the local areas. So there I was able to see like Jamestown and Williamsburg and the naval base there at Norfolk, Virginia, and was able to tour many ships. So always being a history buff, I was able to see all of these other areas, plus also would go to Washington, D.C. About two or three times I would go to D.C. and see all of your tourist stuff there, like your Washington Monument and the Smithsonian and the White House and the Capitol. So I really enjoyed my stay there at Fort Eustis.
Very good. Through all of this training you've had, both at Fort Polk and at Fort Eustis, you know pretty well you're going to be sent to Vietnam.
Yes.
looking back at it today, knowing what you saw in Vietnam, do you feel that your training, both at Fort Polk and especially at Fort Eustis, do you feel that your training was adequate? Do you believe that your training put you in as good a position as you could be in for the real thing once it started?
Yes, I believe what. I believe that no matter, you know, what type of training you have, you're not going to get the full picture until you are actually involved in it.
Sure.
Right, it's kind of like college, and no matter how many books that you read or anything, you won't know it until you're actually working in your profession.
Mm-hmm. Which part of your training did you like the best at Fort Eustis? Was it the weapons training? Was it the mechanical training?
Okay, well, I liked the mechanical training, you know, working on the helicopters. As a matter of fact, when I completed my Huey school, there was about 22 of us in my class. And our first 22, they selected, I believe, two of us to go on to Chinook helicopter school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure you're right, on your Chinook, your CH-47 Chinook, which I would see flying every once in a while. And I really didn't like them because, to me, they looked like a flying shoebox with two propellers. I wanted to go into Huey's because that's the one I would always see in the newspapers.
Sure.
Well, anyway, I went ahead and they told me to go to it, so I went to it. And that was more weeks, more months of training. Since instead of one engine like a Huey, you had two engines, which were larger. And instead of one main transmission, you had two main transmissions plus three other minor ones, and a lot more nuts and bolts and shafting and hydraulics and electricals and all this other stuff. So I was, like with all my classes, I would tend to absorb up everything that I was learning, or at least try to absorb as much, and I really learned to appreciate the Chinook once I got to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absorb a lot more hits.
Sure. The Chinook is definitely a very different beast.
Yeah.
from the UH-1, that's for sure. When your training is done, to what unit were you attached?
When my training was complete.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right after training there at Fort Eustis, Virginia, you know, what, like always, and you go home and leave. And then I went to Vietnam, and I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division.
When did you leave for Vietnam?
Okay, I left in late March. As a matter of fact, I must have arrived in Vietnam probably the last day in March of 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we took off from San Francisco, went to Hawaii, then to Wake Island, and from Wake Island to the Philippines, where we switched over to the military C-141 and made it into Vietnam, landing there in Pleiku. So I was there in a new unit, a company where all of the new people were coming in, until we were finally went out to our home units that we were assigned to, which was the 1st Cavalry Division, which at that time was located at Camp Radcliffe in Anh Ke, Vietnam, in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm. When you stepped off your plane, Pleiku, what was your initial impression of Vietnam?
When I stepped off there in Pleiku?
Yes.
Okay. It seemed that when I stepped off, it seemed that the air smelled different. It smelled, you know, different. It wasn't like, it seemed that the country had a certain smell. I can't describe it, but I knew that it wasn't the USA. It was like being in a foreign country, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It was just different. And onto my side, I saw there must have been about 30 or 40 prisoners of war. They were Viet Cong, and they had those black pajama-like, and they were like tied up. They had the thing that they had like a stick behind their backs where their arms were secured at, and then they were all tied up from neck to neck with a rope. So here I was seeing, how the enemy looked like, and nothing but just military vehicles, jeeps and trucks and bar guys. So it was a very different type of environment.
You were a very long way from San Antonio, weren't you?
Yes.
Well, what did you think about joining the first CAV? By this time, they had established themselves quite a reputation. What did you think about this?
Well, it seemed that my dream came true, because when I was in high school, there in the newspapers, I would always see the Hueys, and then many times I would see the soldiers with the first CAV patch. And I told myself, when I go to Vietnam, that's what I want to do. So it seemed that my dream came true. You know, part of it, you know, I wasn't going to be a pilot, but I was going to be an air crewman, and I wanted to fly. And it seemed that that part of my dream of being in the 1st Cavalry Division came true. And they're from Pleiku, in a C-130 Hercules. We went from Pleiku to Phan K, and there I stepped off, and I knew that now I was going to be a 1st Cav trooper.
Mm-hmm. So you've arrived at Phan K at Camp Radcliffe, as you mentioned.
Yes.
Describe the camp for me, please.
The camp, unlike the military bases here in town, where there's regular buildings with regular streets and asphalt and concrete and electricity and everything, there it was all scattered out. It was like a camp out in the boonies. The buildings were more like wooden structures. When I first went there, like in my home area, Company C is the 228 Aviation Battalion, which is the Chinook Battalion. It seemed that we had some tents, but we also had some hooches that were made out of wooden structures with aluminum roofing. And on the wooden structures and the wooden walls, instead of being a slack wall, they were kind of open up to the side where they had a screen to keep out the mosquitoes, and it had a concrete floor. But when I first got there, I was assigned to a tent. And the tents had a concrete floor, but it was canvas tents, until I finally was assigned to the mechanics, hooch. And so that's where I went. And there they had a regular mess hall, also similar structure, but they have these metal tables. And seeing that our bathrooms, seeing that they had a building where they had all of these it seemed that they were not flush toilets, and you went and you sat on a wooden bench with several holes, and everything was gathered in these half oil cans, which were empty, and the showers, and they were heated up by these type of kerosene with heaters. But like I said, for the bathrooms, for the commodes, every so often the troopers at the new ones and those that were being punished, they had to take out these oil canisters and kind of burn all of the human waste. And it was very different. At one time, we did have electricity, but we had plenty of candles around, because sometimes the generators would go out for one reason or another, so we would have candles and flashlights.
Sure. What was a typical day for you there at Camp Radcliffe?
Okay, typical day. Okay, it would vary. At the beginning, I was not yet on flying status. I was just on the ground team working on the helicopters that would come in. Because the helicopters would come in after they would fly so many hours, they would come in for an intermediate inspection. After 100 hours, it comes in for a periodic inspection, which would require more maintenance, more mechanical work on them. Sometimes the helicopters would come in all shot up, and we would have to work on them. So at first, we would get up and have breakfast, and then we would go out to the flight line. By that time, it was becoming daylight early in the morning, probably around 6:36, and so we would go out there and start working on the aircraft. I myself, being an 18-year-old and kind of gung-ho, whenever they would want the volunteer groups to go out on patrols, I would go ahead and volunteer. Another thing. When we first got to Vietnam and assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division, they gave us weapons. Mm-hmm. They gave me the M16.
What do you think of that? That's quite a change from the M14.
Yes, because there at Fort Eustis and at Fort Polk, I had the M14. Then all of a sudden, I was handled an M16 rifle, and to me, it looked like a toy by Mattel because it was black plastic and a black barrel. And so for 1 week, and we went through training where we would learn to use the M16 rifle and also to take it all apart and then to put it back into firing shape, also began to throw some hand grenades. And then we went out and basically out in the field for a few days to get the feel of the terrain and come back. So I kind of liked that. So when I was working on the helicopters, whenever they would call for some volunteers to go out to out in the field to do some grunt work, and I would always tend to jump at it. So for the first 3 months, when I was a ground mechanic, I would tend to volunteer. So I must have gone out probably on about 4, maybe 5 patrols altogether. And I would always be bugging the first sergeant, you know, when I was going to be transferring over to the flight platoon, because I wanted to be a flying crewman and mm-hmm. not a ground person.
Sure.
So that, you know, I'm kind of... And I saw some stuff out in the field. I saw the dead, ours and theirs. I would tend to, you know, just like infantry, you know, a lot of sweat and a lot of, in the evening, trying to get some of the leeches off of my ankles and try to get all the bugs off of me at the end of the day. And so it was a new experience, but you know, that's what I kind of expected to see in here. Got to see some wildlife, like there was like a black panther. He must have been probably about 10-12 feet in front of me, which he crawled up and he just stared at me with his green eyes, and I just stared at him and he just went away. And there was some bushes, and probably just a few feet away from me, probably about 2 feet away, there was what they call the bamboo viper, which I understand was a very poisonous mm-hmm. snake. And so and that one also went away. And so, you know, it was quite an experience. Got to use the M79 grenade launcher. Being out there in the field, it seemed that my small little unit, we were like a vanguard unit, had to fire one round every 5 minutes all around the clock, you know, and they gave me a big old box of ammo, so that's what I was doing. So to me, that was a challenge and quite an experience.
Once again, you were a long way from San Antonio, by the sounds of it.
Yes, I was a long way from San Antonio.
Now, if you could, now you've given me your personal observations of being on these patrols around the camp there, but could you give me more of an overview? What made up these patrols? What were you intended to do, and how did they work?
Okay. Like I said, these patrols. We were told they were like a vanguard unit. It seemed they got, you know, what some people from the various companies. Like I said, I was in the 228 Aviation Battalion. The 228 Aviation Battalion, which is your Chinook Helicopter Battalion. In the first cab, you had the 227, and your 228, and your 229.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, the 227 and the 229, were Hueys. The 227, those Hueys were like your slicks, meaning that they carried troops.
Right.
We were the 228, and we Chinooks, and we carried troops, and we carried supplies and all this. The 229, that one there, that's where they had like the Hueys that were the gunships. Mm-hmm. And I mean the gunships, not your Huey Cobras, but before that, they were like your B-model Hueys that they fitted out with machine guns and rockets on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were more like your aerial rocket artillery. And so for these patrols, apparently the 1st Cavalry, you know, the infantry units, you know, like, well, they were really the regular cavalry units, but they were really the 11 Bravos, like your 7th Cav, your 5th Cav, I think there was the 9th Cav. You know, they had so many men, but it seemed that they needed more men at times. So, like, from the 228, they would get several of us guys from A, B, and C company, and there would be like about squadrons, like the patrols which I went out on, these Vanguard units, there would probably be about 12 of us, maybe 14. And we would go on out into the field, and we were supposed to have been going up to the field, and we were told, well, this sergeant was the one that was in charge of us. At that time, I was just a PFC, and there was some other private, and so we just followed orders. But it seemed that we were keeping in contact with the main companies or battalions that were out there in the field. We were like from the 5th Cavalry or the 7th Cav, and we were out there, about a mile or two away from their main unit on a certain part of the compass area, going full forward to a specific area. And we were, and I guess we were like the tripwire, so in case of the enemy, be it the NVA or the VC, which would tend to organize large units, would tend to attack, they would be passing by through us, and we would be able to notify.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of patrols that we were out on.
Did you encounter,
no.
Tell me about your first encountering of enemy troops in the field, on these patrols.
Well, on this, I would tell you about my encounters with the enemy on the ground and also in the air, but this came later. Right now, I guess I was very fortunate. What I encountered was, like I said, we could hear some of the fighting going on, and then we kept on going. And at times, you know, but we would run into some of the regular grunts that were ahead of us or to the side of us. And that's where I first saw the dead, ours and theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but to me, it was very shocking, because, you know, when I was a civilian all the way to high school, the few dead I would see, you know, like a grandparent or an uncle.
Sure.
Those persons look like asleep, and they're in a nice coffin, and they're in a nice funeral home and all that. But when you see our dead and they're dead, they're out there in the field, out there in the ground, out there in the sand, out there in the bushes. You know, it's just like worse than what you would see if a dead dog out the highway. You know what? So I found it shocking to know what seeing dead humans, you know, bomb and that type of condition.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike just plain little bullet holes, you know, especially the smaller people, then with the weapons that we use, sometimes, you know, the human body would be torn. And so, you know, there was a few times which almost felt like throwing up, but, you know, like talking with some other guy, you know, trying to talk big, you know, if I would always, you know, but looking at the dead bodies, I would always tend to look above them and concentrate on something else and not
sure.
Give myself away that I'm looking at a broken body.
Right.
You know? And then sometimes we would pass by these villages, and sometimes where there was fighting had gone on before, and you could hear, I guess, the women that had lost loved ones, that they were crying, and they had a certain crying wail to their grief. So all of this, you know, up in my head, you know, observe, and also some of the dead that had been dead for a while, you know, the human body had a certain stench to it,
mm-hmm.
Especially if it had been exposed to the hot sun, it seemed that the bodies would tend to float and bloat and turn blackened after a while. So, you know, all of this was all new to me, and I hoped that I never, you know, would see that. But then I told myself that's what can be expected. So, like I said, you know, and this is what I experienced during my ground. I never did encounter any of the enemy at the ground. I just saw many of the civilians, you know, farmers out there working in the fields or whatnot. But, you know, that was my experience being as a ground trooper.
Okay.
And I finally got through to the first sergeant, and when I came back from my main big patrol there in June, I just turned 19 out there in the field also. That's when I turned 19. When I came back, I was assigned as a gunner. I was going to be a crewman. So I had to take my flight physical. Well, I went to the medics tent, and there I filled out one of those regular standard medical forms, you know, like do you have headaches or nausea, and everything was all no. I gave it to the doctor, and the doctor looked at me and said, son, do you wear glasses? And I said, no, sir. Then he just stamped it automatically, flight approved. You know, he didn't even take my blood pressure or even, you know, check my ears or nothing, you know. So I was very happy, so I went back to the company, and I was assigned as a gunner. And a gunner, just like your pilot, you tend to rotate from aircraft to aircraft. That's why I was able to rack up a lot of flying hours. And as a gunner, I was assigned 2M60 machine guns, assigned with the aerial type of gun handle, but not like your grunt type where that has a stock. And seeing that my job as a gunner was that every morning I would go ahead, and if I was assigned to a certain aircraft, I would go to that aircraft and I would put both of my machine guns on. I would load it up with several rounds of ammunition, with several boxes, which I would have at least anywhere from 500 to 700 rounds. I would also take along an extra barrel with an asbesto glove in case the barrels get too hot, you could change it. And my only mission on working on that aircraft was just to clean out the aircraft at the end of the day. You know, they had a little broom, and I would just sweep out the floor and take out all the crud off of the seats. And being a gunner, like I said, I would tend to rotate from aircraft to aircraft, and I racked up plenty of flying hours. And with the flying hours, we would take off early in the morning when it was still dark, around 4 o'clock. It seemed that the other two crewmen, the flight engineer and the crew chief, and they would do already have pre-flighted the aircraft. So we would load up the aircraft with our troopers. Sometimes we would just take off from one part of the golf course. That's what we would call that helicopter pad that we had scattered all over. We would call the golf course. We'd go from one part of the golf course over to the other part of the base, pick up the troopers. And if we had an early morning assault, we would load up the troopers, and then we would fly over the base around and around in circles, being joined by other helicopters. You know, there's so many Chinooks, we will be flying around. Then there'll be the Hueys, those which were the slicks, and then those that were the gunships, and then the observations. And so we're flying around and around in circles, and I found that a bit kind of scary at times, because you're flying out in the dark. All you have are nothing but just the regular lights on your aircraft, and that kind of blend in with the stars at times. Then after all the aircraft were all gathered, it's kind of like a mad swarm of bees, then we would head on out to wherever we would be hitting. Many times we would hit a village off of the China coast, so we would go on out straight off to the coastline, and once we got to where the village was at, then again we start flying around in circles, and from the big swarm of aircraft, helicopters, down would come like your observation helicopters, which they would fly low over the village and drop flares. And many times, as soon as they dropped flares, it seemed they started getting gunfire. You could see the machine gun was tracers going up at them. And when that happened, then those little bomb observations, and at that time, the observation ones were like your OH-13 SUs, you know, like those which you see like on that MASH program.
Sure.
Right, and then they would tend to fly on off, and then your Huey gunships, which were your UH-1B models, they would come on down and they start machine gunning and rocketing the place, and at times those little villages would catch on fire, and you could see the enemy or the people running all over the place. And when that was happening, we Chinooks and carrying troopers and the Hueys carrying troopers, since it was on the beach, and we would tend to place them on one side of the village, one on the other village, and then those on the other side going into the mainland. And so all of this, you know, was all happening. And once we let the troopers off, then again we started circling on around. And it was, you know, it was quite a sight to see. And so we did this several times on the coastline, then also times inland in the mainline there in the central highland part, and we would do that. And many times, like I said, the VC for the NVA was, well, it's primarily VCs. I guess when they started to lose ground, they would retreat into the mainland, into the jungle. So what would happen is that some of us Hueys, some of us Chinooks, we would come on down, pick up the troopers, and then fly low and kind of like on, do you play chess?
No, I do not.
Oh, okay. Well, like your knight, you know, then you would tend to pick up your troopers and then go around, fly low, and then place them again, hopefully that you'll be blocking them off from their retreat.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do this almost all morning long, and sometimes until the afternoon, depending upon how much of the large group of enemy there was. And it seemed that the rounds, which I would tend to pick up, you know, I would feel like I would be in a garbage can and someone banging it with a hammer. That's the way how I could feel the rounds hitting the aircraft. You know, because it seemed, since your helicopters were flying low level, it seemed that we were very open for your ground fire from the enemy, to start receiving ground fire from the enemy, whether if it's either rifle fire or machine gun fire. So it seemed that this is what I would be experiencing with, and especially, and after we would leave the troops off, you know, we would fly low, but to the top level, was just zigzagging around to see if we could see any of the enemy, so we could return fire upon them, and this would also vindicate to our troopers, you know, where the enemy was at. And then again, we would go up circling on the round until we were needed again. Sometimes when we started running out of fuel, we just fly back to the base and load up with fuel, which would take just a few minutes, probably 15, 20 minutes, and then back to where we were at. And we would come on down, and some of us would come on down for breakfast around 8 o'clock, and then take off again by 8:30 or so, do more flying around, and come back down around 12:30 for lunch, then take off again, you know, by 1. And then finally come on down for supper around 6:30 in the evening, and that was the day.
That would be a very long and eventful day, I would say.
Right, you know. And it seemed that being out there in the field, you know, but a lot of times we would just eat sea rations, or if we landed at an LZ, which was established, and we could have a hot meal. And being a gunner, like I said, I would fly. I'm out of a 7-day week, I would tend to fly 6 days, and on the 7th day, I would be assigned KP back at Camp Ratcliffe. And I didn't mind that, because there I could have three hot meals, and sure, if I would wash my dishes or whatnot, but at least I had three hot meals, and I had regular fresh fruit and everything, instead of just eating out of sea ration cans out there in the field.
Sure.
And one thing which I noticed there in Vietnam, that there is no, it's not a Monday through Friday type of, every day is a work day. There's no 8 to 5. It's from sun up to sundown. And many times when we were hit or the base was probed, you know, we would have to go out there and protect our territory. So like I said, every day was a work day, and it was from sundown to sunup. And back there at Camp Ratcliffe, sometimes the enemy would tend to hit us first with rockets and mortars, and then they would attack the base, and they would penetrate us, and then we would have to go out there to the flight line and try to protect our aircraft. And this is where I would see, you had mentioned ground warfare. The ground warfare was not out there, well, my experience was not out there in the jungles, but right there at our base.
Sure.
Because there you could see people running back and forth. You could see tracers, you could see gun flashes, and they're shooting at each other. And whenever they would be approaching us, before I would fire, I would make sure, is that a VC or is that our guys?
Mm-hmm.
I was always very reluctant to fire right away because I would not want to shoot our guys. Because many times, like I said, we were out there traveling out there to the golf course, and especially when they would penetrate that part of the base, and someone would call for, you know, for us flight crewmen, you know, to get our M16s and follow them out. And when we were traveling out there in the darkness, like I said, sometimes I wonder, you know, if we would be shot at by our own guys or would we be shot at by the enemy. So, you know, that's the way how it was. So, so I did that as a gunner for 3 months, and then I was promoted. I was a PFC in E3. Then after that, I was promoted to crew chief. I made E4. So now, instead of being a gunner on the left-hand side, now I was a gunner on the right-hand side. And being a crew chief, I was assigned to an aircraft. I would not be flying as many many flight missions on CAs and combat as well,
right,
like I did as a gunner, because I was assigned to a certain aircraft to take care of it, to help out the flight engineer, since you know that Chinook is a large aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get you as a crew chief here,
yes,
let me take me back to your first mission out of the camp. The first time you are in a Chinook, you're dropping off soldiers and you're flying support.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember when and where that mission was?
I know that it was in the Central Highlands, but exactly I do not know. I know that most of our flying was there in the Bong Song area,
mm-hmm,
Ding Ding province, you know. It was more than the Bong Song area.
All right, well, as a 19-year-old, you say you turned 19.
Right.
While you were there, as a 19-year-old who was getting fired at in Vietnam, what is going through your mind?
Okay, when I was being fired at and I could hear those rounds hitting the aircraft, right away I started looking outside, starting to see where the fire was coming from so I could return the fire.
Mm-hmm.
I did not just want to shoot into the huge jungle in front of me. I wanted to see where the, you know, if I could see a gun flash, if I could see the enemy. And it seemed that, you know, I did get a few kills, but only when I saw the enemy running on out.
Do you think that was as a result of your training, or do you think it was instinctive? What do you think?
I think that it was just, part of my training, but also just my own, you know, luck, you know. I just was reluctant into just shooting ammunition and just wasting away. I wanted to shoot at a target and not just shoot emptily into the jungle.
Mm-hmm. What do you, now you've encountered the enemy now, both NVA and VC. What was your impression of their abilities in the field?
Well, like I said, when I was first flying as a gunner, I think that most of the enemy there that we encountered was your VC.
Mm-hmm.
It was later on, you know, later on the year, which I will get to, you know, eventually, but it seemed that your VC and your NVA, I know that your NVA was your North Vietnamese Army, and you could tell that they had different type of uniform.
Mm-hmm.
They had like little headgears of some type, you know, but I never did get to see them up close. But it seemed that their uniforms were different, unlike your VC. You see that most of your VC had like your black pajama type,
mm-hmm,
and they were wearing your traditional, you know, with those conical straw hats.
Sure.
Right. And their weapons, first, I couldn't tell if they were AK-47s, but to me, it looked like they had something else before I started seeing your AK-47. But again, it was at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I didn't have that many kills, but I remember my very first kill. It was in the distance, and saw this one guy, and seemed that he took off from the bushes, and he made himself seen. You know, he was out there in the open area. So I opened fire on him, and I could see my rounds all around him, and then I could see all the red on his black pajama as he fell down.
Mm-hmm.
And when that day was over with, you know, at first I felt kind of bad, you know, them, I guess, through my Catholic religion, you know, to send to kill. But, you know, there was this one sergeant, I forgot his name, but he told me that, you know, who would you rather have crying, you know, if you would have, if that guy would have shot you and killed you, you know, just picture your mother, your grandmother, your aunts all crying, you know, and, but you shot this one guy, and so his mother and grandmother and aunts are going to be crying, but you don't know how he looked like, you don't know how his family looked like, so, you know, it really shouldn't faze you, but only it should faze you only if you were the one to have gotten killed. So, in a way, you know, I kind of, you know, I'm accepted that, you know, if anyone's going to die, I'd rather let the other guy die, but I want to go home in one piece.
Of course, that's, one has to rationalize their role is there in taking lives.
Right, so, there were several, you know, I got, you know, I might have had that many killed at all, but I remember what, I was still a gunner, you know, still on my left-hand side, you know, we had attacked this one village, and we had dropped some CS to kind of flush them out, and then, like I said, I mean, it was like a bend on the river, this little village, and we had put all of our troops on one side, and it seemed that the enemy, instead of surrendering, or try to fight their way out, a lot of them were trying to swim across this wide river.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen that there was like Chinooks and some Hueys, and they were just like hovering across the river, and we're just shooting them like ducks in the water. And so, you know, that's the only time I've ever shot two in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling is that, you know, the more you kill today, the less of them will be around tomorrow trying to shoot you.
Sure.
You know what? You can get up to that attitude, especially when you lose certain friends. You know, like in the morning for breakfast before we started flying, you know, then you'd be talking with some of the other bear crewmen, you know, and sometimes by supper time, you know, you find out that so-and-so either got shot and killed or shot and wounded and sent over to Japan because it was bad. So, you know, this just learn to accept that it's just part of your job. So if you destroy the enemy, they'll be less of them trying to destroy you, especially if you see some of your friends not returning.
Sure, sure. Now, that is, it's an attitude that you developed over time and probably developed it rather quickly, I would guess. But that first night when you came back in, and you mentioned that your sergeant had talked to you about this.
Yes.
But what are you thinking, and how are you reacting to the fact that as a 19-year-old you just took someone else's life for the very first time?
Yes, well, at first, like I said, you know, at first I thought that there was a sin, you know. When I shot him and he fell down and I knew that I had probably killed him, you know, since he all in red, you know, I felt kind of shaking my knees that I had killed someone, you know, but then, you know, still hearing more rounds, hitting us, I went ahead and still kept on returning fire whenever I would see any muzzle flashes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that, you know, well, we just put our troops down on the ground, so, you know, but if we can shoot the enemy, we'll shoot them, so there'll be less of them to shoot us.
Sure.
Up in the very near future, especially since we put our troops down on the ground.
Sure. What weapon did the enemy have that bothered you, that caused the most fear for you and other crewmen?
Well, like I said, you know, I was not on the ground, I was up in the air, so I
really
could not see exactly what type of weapons they were using. It wasn't until later, which I would tell you what later on, what I know that I seen the AK-47,
mm-hmm.
but I know that they must have used something else because it looked like it's a 30 round, and it seemed that would tend to puncture our sides and our flooring quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was very lucky. As a matter of fact, when I was flying as a gunner, which was now up on the right-hand side, I used to receive hits, you know, all over. Well, I'm even close to where I was at, and I even remember one time after a real hot LZ that we landed in, know, I was looking all around, and I looked by my left foot, and on my left foot on the floor, just about an inch or two away from my left heel, there was a bullet hole. It was, and luckily it was just a 30 caliber, no, nothing big like 50, but 30 caliber. So there was a hole on the flooring by my, close to my left heel, and then I looked up in the ceiling of the aircraft, and there was the exit hole. And I found myself that I was very lucky that it missed me just by an inch, because, you know, to me that was about the closest time that I've ever had experience around, because I was just looking at that hole that was created, you know.
Sure.
Sure, there were other holes that had been created, you know, not by a yard away from me, you know, where the sheet metal man would have to be all patched up,
mm-hmm.
the holes, but, you know, when you start to just receive hits, but every time you start to receive hits, you start looking around to see where the gunfire is at so you can return the fire. And also, while flying, you know, there in Vietnam, you know, we lost, the Army lost many helicopters, went down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think altogether there was over 6,000 helicopters that went down eventually. You know, most of them were Hueys. I think of your total Chinooks, I think around almost 200 Chinooks went down throughout the whole war there. You know, and several thousand Hueys went down. And because many times when we would be flying into these LVs and everything, you know, I would always see a down Huey. You know, if it was always either upon its body rotated on down on its skids, or it would be on the side, or it would be upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And only one time did I ever see one go down, and at that time I was still a gunner. And one of the pilots said, "Look, he's going down." And I stuck my head out and I looked forward, and there was a Huey. It was a Slick, and I later found out that it still had its troopers on board, and it was almost like in a straight nose down position. When I stuck my head out, I saw this Huey, and just a split second later, he hit the ground and went into a ball of fire. That's the only time I've ever seen a Huey go down, because, you know, since we don't fly that high, you know, our trip down into the ground is much more quicker. It's not like seeing the World War II movies where you see a B-17 that's been shot down, you know, fall several thousand feet down into the earth. You know, here, well, it's just a quick trip. It might be 20 feet or 200 feet, and it's a quick trip down into the ground. And that's what had happened. You know, that's what I saw. You know, later on, I found out. So later on, when I was as a gunner, which was now on the right-hand side, you know, like I said, every time we would come on down for a rest, the high as a crew chief, the flight engineer, we would always check out the drive shafting, seeing that there's a lot of drive shafting, and sometimes it would break the resilient mounts that would go to the drive shafting. So we had a footlocker just full of them, because we always had to replace them, because we didn't want for a piece of drive shafting to fly off and then the whole helicopter would come on down with everyone in it. So we would always do that. As soon as we would come down for a meal, we would check it out, or come on down for the end of the day. So that's what we would do. You know, that's what I would do. You know, and being as a crew chief, being a gunner on the right hand side, that's the only time I've ever shot only just one person, and that's when I saw that it was an AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that in that war, you know, they tend to give out more credit to really what's being done. And I say this is because we came on down on a hot LZ, and it seemed that this one, he must have been a Viet Cong, he came out to this one structure. It was like a adobe structure, and he came out, and I don't know why he charged at us. I don't know if the guy was on drugs or not, but I saw him, and I fired at him. And I also noticed that there was another Chinook off to my right, and that gunner fired at him, so there was like two streams of M60 rounds that just hit his body.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that his arm that was carrying the AK-47 just flew off of his body, while he just fell in half on down. You know, and then later on, you know, I found out that that gunner and I, well, we both got credit for the same kill. You know, and so like I said, you know, but it just that numerical of kills for the day, you know, just know, a body count or whatnot, you know, they might know how inflated they were or whatnot, but
sure.
Anyway, what, and that's the only experience which I noticed, you know, which I got as a flight engineer, what I mean as a crew chief, which is on the right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I didn't fly as many missions because I was then assigned to one aircraft, which I would be helping out the flight engineer. And so every time the aircraft would come on down, we would be sure that all the hydraulic levels were up to par, all the oil levels, that the engines were running right, and check out all the drive shafting and all the nuts and bolts and safety wiring and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, when I was still as a gunner, we were moving out the mountain yard people. We were moving them from one area to another area.
Tell me about that.
Right. I almost forgot about that. And it seemed that at one time, when we moved these people on out, and I noticed that there was like a small little pig, a black hairy pig, had wires around his snout, and I picked him up. He was under the bench seat, under the canvas bench seat. Picked him up, and I went outside the helicopter, and I saw this one Vietnamese soldier, and I just gave it to him, and I just ran back into the aircraft. And there was another incident where we moved some more mountain yard people, and they had a cow, and this cow, I guess, really didn't want to go into the aircraft, was since, you know, the aircraft is always running with its big rotor blade.
Mm-hmm.
So we forced the cow inside, but we had to strap down the cow. So being from Texas, you know, they told me to go ahead and strap down the cow. So I got the cow's head and I kind of twisted, you know, like they do in the rodeos, and
right.
Bulldog it on down. It seemed that I had a hard time trying to bulldog it on down. So the other two crewmen, they came and they grabbed his legs and we knocked it down, and then I strapped it down with the cargo straps. So after we got the people out, I unstrapped the cow. The cow looked at me and left me a great big souvenir. And then being the gunner, you know, I had to use a shovel to get all that stuff out. I couldn't sweep it out. You're right. So that was about the only, you know, comical thing which I remember of being as a.
You'd been promoted to cowboy pretty quickly.
Right, and being from Texas, I know, hey, well, you can do that. Anyway.
Well, tell me, Mr. Alvarez, what was the purpose of moving the Montagnard people from one place to another?
What I understand is that the Montagnard people were being moved to a more secure place.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that apparently where they were living at, it was too exposed to the Viet Cong, and not so much your NVA, but to the Viet Cong, since they were mostly mixing with the civilian population.
Sure.
They needed to be in a more secure place. And I forgot what program it was, but it seemed that they were being moved to another makeshift village where they were more secure with barbed wire and more Arvin troops, because not only did we fly our troops into combat, but we also flew a lot of Arvin troops.
Mm-hmm.
And National Police troops. So apparently these Montagnard people were being moved to a more secure place where they would not be have so much contact with the VC that would tend to do them damage. Because I remember going through those villages that it seemed that when the VC would not be able to transform some of the villagers into their type of beliefs, it seemed that some of the villagers got hurt or killed or whatnot.
Sure.
Right, because I've seen a few, you know, when I was still on police patrol, you know, that's when I got to see some of your civilians that had been shot and killed or shot and wounded. But anyway, so I'm not flying as a gunner. Like I said, I was on E4, a Spec 4.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was still pulling KP, you know, but not so often. And it was just quite an experience. And there was a few missions which were not combat that we would be taking some important papers from Camp Ratcliffe, like to Queen Yan or whatnot. And
mm-hmm.
We also would pick up your USO people, you know, these entertainment groups, these
sure.
bands or whatnot. But the vast majority of them were not Americans, but they were either Filipinos or Koreans. I think only one group, which was an American magician and his daughter that was a dancer was the only American, but all of the other rock groups were either Koreans or Filipinos, which back at the base camp there, at Camp Radcliffe, you know, back at the service club, you know, whenever I was lucky and I was back enough, you know, I could be entertained and listen to their music or whatnot. But then that's what I noticed also, that most of the USO troops were Asiatic.
Mm-hmm.
And then after doing that for 3 months, then I became a flight engineer, and I was promoted to a Spec 5. I was a junior NCO now. So again, I was assigned to an aircraft. And for winter, for Christmas, 67, seeing that my aircraft came down for some maintenance, and it seemed that the next day, I and some other air crewmen, we went to Phuket Air Force Base, and we got to see the Bob Hope show.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, yes. It was with Raquel Welch and Miss World. I forgot if she was from Brazil or from someplace. But let me tell you something. When we got there to Phuket Air Force Base, they must have been about three or four of us Chinooks. Most of them were grunts, and about one of us was only flying. But anyway, well, we joined in with the grunts in formation. And when we got there to Phuket Air Force Base, you could see the stage. It was way in the distance, and you could barely make out there were like some benches up front. But all the rest in front of us was like a sea of humanity. It was a few Air Force people. And so, you know, these Air Force people, you know, but they saw us, and as we organized and as we marched in through, and I noticed that their Air Force bases was kind of like our civilian air bases with asphalt streets and concrete and air conditioners sticking out of, you know, makeshift buildings and trailer homes and all that. And so we marched in a mass formation, like a platoon formation, and we marched forward straight to the stage. And all of these Air Force people, which were several thousand of them ahead of us, you know, they like parted, you know, we kind of like parted the sea. And all of these Air Force people were saying, look, horse soldiers, because they could see our first cap patch on our shoulders.
Right.
So we marched all the way forward, and we got those benches up front. So apparently the benches was for us combat troopers, while the Air Force, you know, were secondary. And so there I got to see Bob Hope and Raquel Welch, and I had to run out of film, of course, so I just got only two snapshots. And so that was quite enjoyable.
Sounds like you hit the jackpot with that one.
Pardon?
Sounds like you hit the jackpot with that one.
Yes, yes.
Well, yes. When you finish up these missions, and as you said, it was 7 days a week. There were no weekends or anything. But when you come in from one of these missions,
yes.
In the evening, or when the fight is when the fighting is over, when your part of the fighting is over,
sure.
And you're back to Camp Radcliffe, give me the a typical winding down period for you.
Okay, the winding down is a flight engineer. You know, we would come on down, and like I said, the gunner would get his machine guns and his ammo and everything else, and would go on to some other aircraft. But the crew chief and myself, the flight engineer, like I said, that was my baby, but I was the one that my signature would go into that aircraft book for the maintenance. And so I would go ahead and check out the aircraft. If we would come down like late, like around 7 or so, first I would get supper and then check out the aircraft. And like I said, I would just check out the transmission and the engine oils and the hydraulics and check out to see if any of the bullet holes has punctured anything vital that I may or may not call the sheet metal man to go ahead and repair. If any hydraulic lines were flicked, well, since the helicopter had a primary and secondary hydraulic lines, you know, in case of one went out, we relied on the other, but we had to take care of the ones that was punctured, so we had to replace the lines, and so I had to do any type of mechanical work on the aircraft. It seemed that the crew chief and I would do work on it, sometimes take a few minutes or a few hours. while the pilots, like I said, and they would go and they would have, since they're the ones flying, you know, and we want for them to be in good physical health, you know, they would go ahead and they would do their own peaceful thing of playing cards or whatnot. But I myself am, I would just be working on that aircraft along with my crew chief and getting it ready for the next day. And after an aircraft has flown so many hours, like I said, it would come down for an intermediate inspection, which requires more inspecting and more maintenance for it to be done on it. Or if it's periodic, which equals to 4 intermediates, it requires more work on it. But, you know, I just wanted to be sure that the aircraft was in good flying condition, because I went up in the aircraft, the air crewmen went up in the aircraft, and many other people go up in the aircraft, and I just want to be sure it stayed in one piece. Now, the helicopters have hundreds of working pieces, you know, from the big blades to a whole bunch of transmissions and drive shafting. And it was during the last 3 months of being a flight engineer that my aircraft went down. The first time was in January. We were still in the Central Highlands, and we were flying in a place called the Happy Valley. Happy Valley. I don't know exactly where it was in the Central Highlands, but we were flying. We started receiving hits, and this one hit, it hit the combining box. Now, the combining box is a transmission that takes in the drive shafting from the big front rotor blade to the rear rotor blade. It also takes a transmission with the drive shafting from number one and number two engines on each side. So it seems that combining box, that combining transmission, that's what keeps the blades separately. Because these blades, you know, are almost hitting each other, but they're kind of like in synchronization, that they're just missing each other. So it seemed that we were flying, we receive a hit in the combining box. The pilot up front, you know, told me, "Chief, you know what? I, the flight engineer, that we just got a hit in the combining box. You know, we're going down, because you don't want to. As long as your blades are still working, all in one piece, you want to come down in one piece, so this way you can take care of business." So we came down in one piece. We were out there in the middle of nowhere. We came on down, and luckily, there was still enough fluid, transmission fluid, in that combining box that our blades did not clash. So we came down all together nicely in one piece. We came down there in the middle of nowhere, and when we landed, there were two Green Berets, a master sergeant and a first lieutenant, and probably around 200 irregular forces. So it seemed that they form a perimeter around us, and this first lieutenant and master sergeant, you know, told us to follow them, and we followed them into the boonies, and some bushes opened up, and then we went down, and it was like a little tunnel, you know, barely wide enough for your shoulders to go on down there. And so we went on down and followed them, and there they had a radio, and there we were able to call back Camp Radcliffe and let them know that we had received a hit in our combining box to go ahead and send us a replacement, and hopefully that our chopper would be in one piece, because we had the irregular forces scattered about the helicopter to keep the enemy away. And we were also hoping that the enemy would not have any mortar rounds to put an end to our chopper. So anyway, we had a nice warm meal. These two Green Berets, and they were happy to see us, because they told us that we were the first round eyes that they had seen in 6 months.
I see you were very, very lucky to have landed
the
Chinook where you did.
Right. Instead of having the blades clashing with each other and coming down like a brick, you know.
Right.
Well, anyway, so seeing that the following day, a Huey came in with people from the 15th TC. That was like a more of the upper level people that work on your Chinooks. You know, they're much more prone to working and taking apart like your transmissions and your engine.
Sure.
So it seemed that they came with an extra transmission, and your Hueys, like I said, there's an open port in the roof which you can put a makeshift crank, and that's what we did, you know, a little crank to lift up the transmission,
mm-hmm.
Put it on in. And all the time while we're doing that, I was kind of worried that from afar, you know, Babisi might see it working on top of the chopper, but apparently the irregular forces, they must have put them scattered pretty well far all around us, and they kind of kept the enemy away. You know, so we put a transmission on that thing, and then we finally flew on out of there. So we were, as I was very thankful for the Green Berets and the regular forces.
Oh, absolutely. Was there any enemy fire?
No.
None?
There was none. The only enemy fire that we received was when we were flying. So apparently, whoever fired on us, that they must have eventually gave way to the people that we had let down.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this happened in January. We were still there in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Tet Offensive started toward the end of that month.
Well, let me, before we get into that, because I think that you mentioned in the forms you filled out for us that you were involved in the Battle of Hue later on. So I certainly want to spend quite a bit of time on that before we're finished. But if I can right now, let me switch gears here a little bit and talk about a particular, I don't know if it's safe to call it a battle or not, but in November of 1967, the 4th Infantry Division the battle, I guess, of Dock Toe, Operation MacArthur, and your unit was working in support of the 4th Infantry Division.
Yes.
In Kontum province around the area of Dock Toe. What was the role of the 1st Brigade, the 1st Cav in the Battle of Dock Toe?
Okay, we were supporting the 4th Infantry. I forgot what regiment we were taking in, but again, we were supporting. We were placing the troopers, even some of them. We were placing them wherever the enemy was approaching at, or we believed they were at, and we were placing our troops, you know, certain positions, you know, along the valleys or along the plains. Not only would we just leave our troopers there where they wanted to be at in order to engage the enemy, but we would also fly in your sea rations, fly in water blivets, and fly in. We would tend to move the artillery pieces from one point to another point, including their ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
So this way, while we would tend to move our infantry and artillery pieces all around the area whenever we would be thinking of wherever they thought that the enemy would be at. And also, it was very dusty, it was very hot, and there was a lot of mosquitoes and a lot of rats.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing that one time a rat jumped onto the aircraft and at night ate up all of the molding and insides of one of the air crewmen's helmet. They had to get another helmet for that guy, but they were large rats. But that's what we were doing. We were supporting the infantry and the artillery. Like I said, we would move the infantry into position, and sometimes into fighting position. And whenever it was a fighting position, that's when we would expect to be getting rounds and everything, because many times we've seen that we were placing our troops almost right on top of the enemy, at times. And like I said, well, the one good thing about our infantry, they always had support from artillery, and that's because we always tend to move the artillery. I think those were the smaller 105 guns that we would tend to move into play so they could always be supporting our grunt. Right, and so that happened there at Dock Toe and Kontum and during the month of November. And I remember one time when we had landed, there was some air base there that the Air Force has, and there were some aircraft there. There were like some C-130s and some C-123s, and we landed there because, our helicopter, our Chinook, needed some fuel. So we landed there, and we fueled up, and as soon as we pulled away, that base started getting mortar and rocket rounds, and when I look back, one of the C-130 Hercules was all on fire, and there's a big old blaze.
Now, this is at the airfield at Dock Toe.
At the airfield there at Dock Toe. Or at Kontum, I should say, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How aware were you, Mr. Alvarez, of why Operation MacArthur in the 4th Division why it was taking place?
At that point, I would not know. I do not know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At that time, no.
Sure. Sure, you were much busier as a...
I was just mostly concerned on keeping, being an air crewman and just on keeping the helicopter flying.
Sure, I completely understand that, for sure. Now, this Operation MacArthur in Kontum Province lasted about a month. How often were you involved? How many days out of the week were you flying?
Well, like I said, at that time in November, I was still, I was a crew chief then.
Mm-hmm.
So we would tend to fly for about 2 to 3 days, come back down for maintenance, then go out and fly another 2 or 3 more days.
Okay. So you'd fly.
And the reason we fly 2 or 3 more days, I say, is because a helicopter, once it flies 25 hours up in the air,
mm-hmm.
come back down and pull and inspection on it, pull in that intermediate inspection.
Okay.
So, and that intermediate inspection would only last about half a day, and then we'll be back on the field.
Okay, so you were flying out of on K.
For ducto and everything, we were out there up in Kontum.
Oh, okay, okay. I
right, right. And we had moved our, sometimes we would have these established LZs. And so there at ducto and everything, we just created our own LZ on out there where we would have some mm-hmm. some POL for aircraft.
Sure.
Right. So there at ducto, if I remember that we were there probably for about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and before we came back to Mount K.
Sure. Now, this was a rather large operation.
Yes.
And it was a very intense operation. What are your impressions of your time there in the doctor?
My impression is on that we're moving about. Instead of being in the central highlands where it's more mountainous and everything, there
mm-hmm.
it was more of a plain,
mm-hmm.
More flat terrain. So, and it was kind of further to the northwest of where Anke was at.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But other than that, I really couldn't tell you about that much more, that it was much more sandier and much more mosquitoes.
You're right. Seems like people always remember the mosquitoes.
Yes.
Well, do you feel that the that you, as well as the 4th Division, I believe the 173rd Airborne Brigade there was there as well, do you feel that you were making a positive difference there? Do you feel that you were accomplishing the goals?
Oh, yes. And I felt, whenever we would move about, I always felt that we were doing well in the war, that we were,
mm-hmm.
That we were reaching our goals, and that's why we were moving about. And this was just my general impression as a general type of NCO that was there in the area.
Mm-hmm.
That we were, by meeting our goals. And you mentioned the 173rd, that's that airborne brigade there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them in January, it was before the Tet Offensive. Well, we were still there, but on K there at Kent Radcliffe. And like I said, many times the enemy would tend to penetrate the camp and we would have to fight them on out. Well, it seemed that in January, to me, this was most prophetic in my mind. It seemed that they hit us. They always hit us early in the morning around 2 o'clock. It must have been, and I think that it was like a Monday morning around 2 o'clock. It seemed that the enemy penetrated. They really hit us with a lot of rockets and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
And right away, it seemed they penetrated, and right away they called for us, flight crewmen, to gather these. They gave us the Remington 10-gauge shotguns to go down to our aircraft and down the golf course and down to where our Chinooks were at to protect them. So this happened like on a Monday morning around 2 o'clock. Seeing that a lot of enemy penetrated, there was a lot of shooting and firing. That's why I was very hesitant at shooting some of these people that were running around, because it might be our own troopers. I did not
sure.
want to shoot our own people. And you could see these tracers flying all around you. you could see our yellow traces, you could see their green traces flying all around you, but even by hearing them, you could hear the zing, zing pass by your head, you know. It was rather, you know, you see all of these people, you know. It's not like in the movies, like Platoon or John Wayne, where it's the base camp is being hit and overrun, that, you know, that they're shooting all over. Here you have to be much more careful that you're not shooting your own troopers, because the enemy would just mix it in with our own troops all around.
Sure.
And this was Monday morning around 2 o'clock. Then the same, it happened during the daytime. Like I said, they were bold. They were hitting us, attacking us during the daylight, all of Monday. Then Monday night, Tuesday, and then Wednesday morning, I was hungry, I was sleepy. All I had was just a sandwich to have eaten for the 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that the first cab, they brought in the 173rd, and they lined up from one end of the camp to the other end and just went in a straight line just to be sure that they got all the VC on out, and I was glad to see them. So there I was, hungry and sleepy, for those two and a half days, and I was glad to see the 173rd, and they always stuck in my mind, the 173rd. They came to our rescue. I guess most of our own troopers were out either in the Central Highlands or up north someplace.
Right.
And couldn't come down to help us.
Yeah, I bet you remember that.
This was in early part of January. And like I said, the Tet Offensive didn't start till the last part there in January.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, many observers look at the battles in November of 1967 in the Dakto region, and they see this as being a victory of sorts, in that these types of actions forced the United States to begin to shift its forces from the cities and from these larger camps out into the countryside, which then, of course, left the cities and larger posts less well defended in preparation for the Tet Offensive. Now, I'm not going to debate how true that is or not, but could you comment on that? What would you say to someone who said that was the case? Although you were very successful, like you mentioned, in Dak To, what would you say to someone who said that, yes, you were successful there in fighting them, but in the long run, this opened up these airfields and these posts and these larger cities to the larger battle that was to come?
Well, you know, if someone was to ask me that type of question, I will let them know that I could not really answer that, because I was just a simple soldier. I was just like a small piece of the puzzle.
Sure.
I could not see the whole puzzle to see what the whole puzzle would create.
Mm-hmm.
I was just myself as a small piece, and all the people around me, which I knew, you know, the other air crewmen and the pilots, you know, about what we were doing. And it seemed that wherever I was at, where we were doing, my vision of the first cab, which is the small part which I was involved in, you know, we were doing well. But the overall picture of exactly how the terrain feature is, or the strategic picture is of that campaign, I could not really say anything, because I'm not a general or a colonel that was involved in it.
Sure, sure. Okay, terrific.
I was just a regular, simple soldier out there in the field.
Right.
And when I mean out there in the field, like I said, those are the days when the Army used to pay, you know, people in money.
Mm-hmm.
And that helicopter paycheck with the paymaster would come, and I would get $50. All the rest would be sent home. I would go get my $50, hold it in my hands, and I'd look all around at this LZ, and what can I do with this $50? And there's no PX, there's nothing. That's why I just put it in my pocket, and I was able to save up, you know, several hundred dollars just that way. You know, but that was not the gambling type either.
Sure.
And whenever they would bring in some Coca-Cola and beer, you know, we would drink that stuff hot, because there was no ice boxes or anything.
Right.
You know what? I would buy myself a 24-pack of Coca-Cola and carried on my rucksack, you know, when I was on the field, or carried in my helicopter, and that was a lot better than drinking the regular water we had. Yes, right. And so, let's see, well, we were up now, up to late January of 68 now.
Okay, well, I think that was probably a pretty good point to stop for the day, and we can pick this up at a later time. If you can hold on for just a second, I will turn off the recording equipment, and I'll chat with you a little bit longer, all right?
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Alfred Alvarez. Today is the 5th of June, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Alvarez is joining us from San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Mr. Alvarez.
Good morning, sir.
Mr. Alvarez, when we left off on Tuesday, you had taken us through your experiences in the Kontum Valley. Now, this particular operation ended for all intents and purposes, and the first CAV's efforts in this operation ended in the end of November of 1967. Now, you also, the first CAV also participated in the Tet Offensive Battle at Hue in late January and all through February of 1968. And I certainly want to pick up on that part of the story. But what I would like to do before then is explain to me, if you can, what you were doing. What was your typical routine? What were you doing between the end of November of 67 and the end of January of 1968 with the beginning of the Tet Offensive? What occurred in those couple of months?
Okay, well, in those few months, in 1967, in November and December, I was still a crew chief, and it was until the last day of December that I was promoted to a flight engineer. So I was promoted to a specialist fit, an E-5 pay grade,
mm-hmm.
because a regular flight engineer slot on a Chinook is an E-6 slot. And I was very glad. Here I was, a 19-year-old E-5 specialist fit, and I was now the flight engineer. And, of course, now I was a junior NCO, so I was completely exempt from KP and regular guard duty, but my sole responsibility was the flight health of the aircraft. I was assigned a certain aircraft, and I kept the book, the log on it, to be sure that everything was functioning properly in that aircraft, since now it was on my hands that every time the aircraft flew up, that it would stay in one piece, and we would all be safe, not just myself, but also the rest of the flight crew and any passengers that we would take on the board. And so to me, I was very happy that I had finally became an NCO. And in January, while the 1st Cavalry was still there at Camp Radcliffe, it seemed that I visited the NCO club and instead of the regular service club. And I really didn't like it because it seemed that all of the NCOs were older men, and here I was, a junior one, and just a few other junior ones like myself, a 19-year-old. So, you know, I prefer going to the regular enlisted service club that we had there at Camp Radcliffe, which was a little piece of recreation where one could go get a drink and sit down and listen to music, and occasionally might see a USO show whenever they would pop up. And like I said, this was still in January of 68. And I believe earlier I had told you about we went down because a round had hit our combining transmission and we went down. Okay, so this was about the middle of January. It seemed that we were preparing to move up north, and when the Tet Offensive started, I believe it started around the last day of January of 68, it seemed for sure that we were going to be moving up north to support the Marines, since the Marines were the only military divisions up there defending the DMZ. It seemed that they would need help. So I know that the 1st Cavalry and some other Army divisions went up there. So in February, we moved up north. We went up there by different units, I believe several. One brigade would go up, and then another one, and another one. And I was already up there about the middle of February, then we were just temporary at a place called Phu Bai. It's a Marine base. There they had a hospital, and during the Tet Offensive, it seemed that instead of being hit by mortars and rounds occasionally, here we were being hit by mortars and rocket rounds almost every day and night. So, you know, it was quite a shocking experience to be involved, always expecting rounds to come in. But here we were at a Marine base, and I remember my unit, at first we were the only Chinooks, so just only a few of us that were there at Phu Bai. There were three tents, one for the officers, another one for the flying crewmen like myself, and another one was for your ground crewmen that would be working on the choppers, and a little one-seater latrine and a little one-barrel shower that we've had. And I remember from after one heavy mortar and rocket attack that I went to go visit a Marine hospital that was just a quarter of a mile down where we were at, and it was hit real hard, you know, the thing that the building that composed of that hospital, that Marine hospital, was pretty well in shambles, and it was during this time there's a lot of rain, so it was mucky mud and all over the place. And seeing that we were there supporting the Marines, and the Marines, well, they had their little CH-46 on Sea Knight, I believe that's what they call it, helicopters. They were like like a brother to the Chinook, which is also made by Boeing Vertol, except that they're slightly smaller and don't carry as much, and it seemed that they needed more flying power than Marines. So we were there, and so we were flying both Marines and Army troops onto certain areas. I wasn't yet involved with the way until a little bit later on that month, in February. And I remember one time, it seemed that we had to deliver some package or whatnot to some ship out in the South China Sea. And we went there and we landed on it. It was kind of like an aircraft carrier, except it was designed more for your helicopters to carry supplies on in and out. And we landed there. And there at the, well, I saw was mostly like a cargo type of helicopters, but we landed there, and all these sailors came on about, and they, you know, they always chained on the aircraft down to the deck of the aircraft, to the ship, you know, and they were asking us questions and looking at our uniforms, and, you know, being with the first cab and being in the Army, it seemed that, you know, I was wearing the same type of BDUs for about 2 weeks, and we know we always had mud up to our knees, and so the rainy season due to the monsoons, and I'm sure that we also smell. But I've seen all these sailors was asking us questions about the war there and the ground, and asked us to look at our weapons, like the M60 machine gun and our M16 that we carried, and our handguns and that we carried in ourselves, and they even invited us for lunch meal, which we gladly accepted. It was the first nice warm cooked meal, and these sailors, you know, they want to take pictures with us together and all this, so we did that, you know. And then when we went on back to the same routine, and it was mostly flying missions up early in the morning while it was still dark, and taking troopers out to the field, and then sometimes taking them supplies and then moving them about. And then when we started, before I started going to Wei, I think that we had some missions up closer by the DMZ where we took a lot of hits. It was by a place called Dong Ha, which is like in between Wei and the DMZ, but slightly more toward the west. We received a lot of hits. It seemed that one of our engines, number two engine, it seemed that it wasn't working properly. And so one of the pilots, you know, seeing his instruments, he told me to look out the porthole. I looked out the porthole and I looked at the engine, and it seemed that one of our work platforms and some of the metal from that aft pylon was just falling apart, and one of it had kind of fell on top of the air and take out that engine, and it seemed that a lot of that sheet metal there from that pylon was just flying off. So right away we landed out there in the middle of nowhere, and luckily we had already left the troops out, so it was just us air crewmen on board the aircraft. And it seemed that we were afraid of flying that aircraft any further, because I know that in past times we have had one or two aircraft that had their aft pylon where the transmission just fly off, and you know, that caused the doom of the aircraft, and we didn't want to be another one. So we just landed on out there, and it seemed there was some troopers from another division. I can't remember if it was the 9th Infantry, or I don't even know if the 4th Infantry was still out there, but they formed a perimeter around us, and the pilots and the gunners, they took off. I was just there with my crew chief, and we were there for a day or two when a helicopter with the sheet metal persons, they came, and they riveted on like a big metal bar, like a like an X on it, with two bars made out of metal, on like an X right on the, this was all on the right hand side of that pylon, because most of it had blown away. So that was to keep the hopefully to keep that transmission still hooked up or to the aft pylon. So when we took off, it was just one pilot instead of two, and myself, the flight engineer, while the well, my crew chief and the rest of that work crew, you know, they flew off with their helicopter that they came on in, which was also another Chinook. So we took off, and the helicopters stayed in one piece, and we went back to Fubai. And also there from Fubai, before the month was out, we were establishing a new base camp called, Evans.
Evans.
Right, that was going to be the new headquarters for the 1st Cavalry, since they were moving from Camp Radcliffe on K now to Camp Evans. And like I said, there we were establishing ourselves, digging in, and like I said, every day, day and night, we would receive rounds. And then, like I said, we were now taking troopers, Marines on out. Not only Marines, but 1st Cav and also the 101st, because I remember seeing then the... And I remember flying into the area. We would always get hits, and I could see like a big building, which I believe they called the Citadel, out in the distance. And we were going back and forth, you know, on different places around that city, leaving our Marines, South Vietnamese troopers, 1st Cav, and 101st people. And it was that first week in March, early March, which we had just let off some Marines, and we took some on board, those that were wounded and a few dead. As soon as we took off, we must have received at least 50 rounds within just a matter of seconds, and down we went. It seemed that, you know, they hit our SAS system, that's like a hydraulic system, and I could see all of this red hydraulic juice just floating, coming down to the flooring was from where it was at, and I could see that red hydraulic fluid, and then I could see the wounded and dead Marines with their bloody uniforms, and you know, the thing that we went down, and also the blades got full of holes. They were whistling, because whenever the blades got full of holes, you know, they started to whistle.
Sure.
Also, I also prayed that the blades would stay on, because if you throw a blade, then the whole helicopter would just tumble on down like a brick. But we came on down, and it's seen that as some other Chinooks had noticed how we went on down, and so we just scrambled on board to another chopper and just flew on out of there.
Now, was anyone hurt in this crash?
Yes. Of the three times I went down, this third time there was a black kid behind me. He was a gunner, and he got wounded in the back, but it was a fatal wound. He died the next day. And all of this happened, which I could see, is because since I was running short on time, I was flying as a flight engineer, and I was flying in the crew chief position, because I was training my crew chief to be the flight engineer in order to replace me, since my time would be up in March. Yeah, so that's why I was in that position, you know, in the gunner's position and in the crew chief position when all this happened. And it seemed that this young black kid, you know, he got fatally wounded. So that's what happened. But
let me ask you this: what? Excuse me. What did? Better question to ask is: how did that affect you? You saw this young man in the Chinook with you in the middle of this crash, received this what turned out to be a fatal wound in the back.
Uh-huh.
When you saw this happen, what's going through your mind?
Well, to be honest, I just told myself, I have only 20 days left in country. I hope I can make it back home.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was my first thing in my mind. I have some for 20 days left in country. And, like I said, these three times that I went down, it always happened during my last 3 months, which I was there. And, nothing like that ever happened when I was flying as a gunner, where I flew a lot more hours than during my last, 6 months. Because when I flew those 3 months as a gunner, like I said, the pilots and gunners, we would switch over from aircraft to aircraft, and sometimes I would volunteer to go on certain missions. So I flew 300 combat assaults during those 3 months as a gunner. As a crew chief, only 100 combat assaults, and as a flight engineer, only 100 combat assaults, and that was because we were assigned to certain aircraft. So that's why there was less, and that's why most of these tragic things happened during the last 3 months. And that's probably because maybe the NVA and the VC were having more firepower directed toward us. Now, of course, all this firepower was from your ground troops, because we just received, firepower, enemy hits from their ground troops at the bottom. It wasn't like the pilots flying up north in jets, that were being shot at with anti-aircraft guns.
Sure.
And surface-to-air missiles here, where we were being shot at by the enemy ground troops. And since we were always flying low, I guess we were always a good-sized target.
And it may have been luck, too, I think, probably,
yes,
as well.
Yes, luck. Let me tell you about luck. It seemed that whenever we would go off on a mission, especially when I was like a gunner, I always hoped that there would be more of us flying in formation, because the more of us that would be up in the air, there would be more of us as targets, and hopefully there'll be a lesser chance that they'll be shooting the other guy and not myself, and not this aircraft, but the other aircraft. So that's the way how I started thinking there for a while.
Sure. Well, let me stop here and back up a little bit and spend a little bit more time on the Tet Offensive and the Battle of Hue.
Sure.
All right. We know the general timeline of all this for sure. Late January 1968,
right.
The Vietnamese and North Vietnamese and Viet Cong unleashed the Tet Offensive, part of which was centered around Hue,
right,
in northern South Vietnam there in I Corps. Now, the first CAV, as you mentioned, was somewhat scattered between, I guess, Phu Bai, Hue area up to just south of, I believe, Quang Tri. Now, various outfits were serving in various capacities up there, and you mentioned that you were serving, of course, as this flight engineer on the Chinooks, moving troops from place to place, both first CAV as well as Marines. Now, in February, before I ask you that question, let me ask you this one: when the Tet Offensive was launched, how much did you know about what was taking place? As a 19-year-old flight engineer, is this something that you recognized as being a massive offensive, or did you see this as being something much more localized? How aware were you of the importance of this?
Okay, I just saw it more as a local thing. I just saw it that we were being shot at, that we were being bombarded, not just at night occasionally, but on a regular basis, both day and night. So this was my concept of the Tet Offensive. I was not aware that it was happening all over the country, but just locally to where I was at, you know, there Bedonghe, and then we moved up north there to Fubai, and then there established to Camp Evans, and they were just being hit. But I was not aware that it was happening all over the country. I did not, you know, well, we didn't have television set, and the local radio that we had up there, I was just mostly just listening to the music, and we really didn't have any newspaper. The Stars and Stripes that we would get, it was usually, you know, at least a month or two old, and we had magazines, you know, Looks, Saturday, Evening Post, Life, but those magazines were old and everything, and tell you the truth, a lot of those magazines were used for toilet paper. Yes, you know, the thing that we were always short on regular toilet paper, so we would use, you know, either the Stars and Stripes or any magazines that we could use.
Right, that's certainly a very common thing in combat,
yes.
What I gather.
Right.
All right, now, you've explained what the Tet Offensive meant to you at least early on. Now, the first CAV served a purpose in the Hue area primarily as blocking further NVA reinforcements as they were trying to make their way into Hue from both the south and the north. The 3rd Brigade of the 1st CAV, I believe it was, sent units, a number of different battalions to different places. What was the 212th and I believe the was the 5/7th, I believe, were sent to the generally to the northwest of Hue between 10-12 kilometers, I believe it was. Now, what role, if any, did you play? Were you responsible for the insertion of these troops, or were you responsible for the supply of these troops?
Both.
Okay, both. Can you tell me about the insertion and the resupply?
Well, with the insertion, you know, but we would take their troops into the area, but like I said, you could see the city and everything, and we would land them on the outskirts of the cities, you know, well, like we were, remember then, I'm trying to recall, I think they were landing our first CAV troopers and the 101st, like on the south and the west.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe the element from the 101st was in the south.
Yeah, with the south,
south
and then the first CAV was up in the north.
Right.
But I remember that we would land them, you know, we had to be sure that we had enough clearance with our big blades,
mm-hmm.
so we could just go ahead and land our troopers. Since the Hueys could land like a squad, we could land like a light platoon of the troopers.
Sure.
So I remember landing them, and every time we would go on in, we would always get, you know, with several hits. So, you know, that could be expected, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we would land them, and we would land several waves. So then, you know, we would go back to the base camps, you know, and then bring in more troopers and more troopers and more troopers. And then we would go ahead and bring in some, ammunition and water and food, you know, up close to where we were leaving them off. And every time we would come on in, you know, we would always get a hit or two because we were still close enough to where all the shooting was at.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, now, do you remember which units that you were inserting and resupplying?
The only one which I can remember, just like you mentioned, the 5th and the 7th,
mm-hmm.
that's Gary Owen.
Okay.
Right. And so that's the only one which I remember.
Okay.
I know that through the years, through the months, I should say, carried several different troopers from our division, but I remember Gary Owen from earlier times up to that Tet Offensive time when we were leaving them their way.
Oh, okay, very good. Now, my understanding is that the weather in early February in that part of Vietnam was pretty poor. It was very poor for flying operations, I think certainly was the case. How did the weather affect your ability to insert these troops and to resupply them?
Well, I know that for certain branches, you know, if the weather is too clouded over and everything, you can't see, you know, then they don't fly.
Mm-hmm.
But being in helicopters, we fly low. So no matter how cloudy it is upstairs, we will always be flying lower than the ceilings where we would always see each other and see the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would fly anywhere from just above treetop level to maybe as high as 200 feet
mm-hmm.
or so. So we would always be flying, and with the weather, especially with the rain, we would be wearing what, like these rain suits, you know, which are more like coveralls and the jacket made out of rubber, you know, and so the rain wouldn't, you know, affect the sun that much. But then we would be flying in very low altitudes and all types of weather, you know, no matter how cloudy there was or foggy.
And very hazardous flying that low.
Well, yes, right, you know. But at that point, what was hazardous is that we were flying very low. We were much more easier targets to be shot at. And also, we had to fly low, but high enough so we could avoid hitting any trees and palm trees and any buildings. So we had to fly that low. But I never got to the point where you couldn't see your pan in your face. Like, I remember it was one time in February, we went out to go pick up a LERP team out there in the middle of nowhere, but at that time it was like foggy, and they would pop pink smoke, but we really couldn't see the smoke because that clearance, the visibility, wasn't that great. And we would fly very slow and slow. I could see like the treetops were like some of the palm trees was almost like brushing the wheels of our helicopter, because that's how low and slow we were doing,
wow,
trying to find them. And it seemed that they would be hearing us, and so they were like directing us, you know, they would be telling us, hey, what, you're to our north or you're to our south or so-and-so degrees. So the pilot would tend to fly low and slow until we could barely make them out on the ground, and then come on down. And to me, I found it hazardous, and not only about flying into a tree or something tall, but also that we just might fly over an enemy unit where they could just pound, you know, rounds into us.
Of course.
We were so low and slow.
Right. Now, there's some controversy within the first CAV, is my understanding, that there were these elements of the 3rd Brigade, in particular the 212th, that because of the conditions and because of the strain placed on logistics as a result of this, you know, countrywide Tet offensive, that there were some of those troopers of the 1st CAV who were on the ground who expressed their belief that they were not supported as well as they believed that they should have been for a variety of reasons. Did you see any of that, or do you believe that's accurate?
That I don't know. I wasn't even aware of that.
Okay.
I wasn't even aware of that. All I remember is that we would take troopers on in, and whenever we would be flying troopers on in, you know, but some of them would give me, like, their letters, which I would take and put in my pocket so I could mail it off for them whenever I would get back to the base camp.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall of any of these infantry troopers, you know, what, discussing that with me at all.
Sure.
Maybe
sure.
It would have been different if I was with the infantry, but I was primarily in this aviation unit.
Sure. Okay, well, the Tet Offensive, or the Battle for Hue in particular, lasts about a month, and
right.
I gather that you were busy for that entire month moving troops from place to place and resupplying them as best you could.
Right.
Eventually, the elements of the 1st CAV and the 1st Arvin Division, and eventually the 1st Marines in Hue, who took so much of the action in this, in the Battle for Hue, eventually turned the tide, and Hue has been cleared of North Vietnamese by the end of February. By that time, did you have a better appreciation for the size, the scale of the Tet Offensive?
Like I said, I was not aware of the size of the Tet Offensive at all.
Okay.
I was just more aware of just the local area where I was participating.
Sure. I would guess that you were so busy in such a very, very busy area that something like that that was, I don't know that you would have had the time, the leisure time, I guess you could say, to find out what else was going on in a larger sense throughout the country.
know. That's right, to know about them. I did not have the time because, like I said, every time we were flying the troops or flying the equipment, food, the extra weapons or whatnot, the aircraft would need maintenance, so we would just come on down back to Camp Evans or to Fubai and work on the aircraft and try to get the aircraft up as soon as possible.
Okay.
So, like I said, there was, and the only little radio I had was a little handheld little radio, which I bought at the PX, which I still have, and they were just listening mostly to the music, and that's about it.
Okay, well, when the Battle for Hue is over, and this again is in toward the end of February, you are running up against the end of your tour, isn't that right, in March of 1968?
Right, I'm in March, yes. And so, like I said, we were establishing Camp Evans, and it seemed that we were still flying the troopers in and out of that area, all around there, that area up around Way and so forth. Because I know that there was that other place up there called Quezon, I believe that they were still under fire and all that. But I was not involved with any of the activities around Quezon. It was some other activities that were all around that area. And like I said, and we were still being hit day and night. And you know, one time the enemy, they attacked us at night, and they penetrated, and they were running all around our aircraft, our tents, our buildings.
Was this at Camp Evans?
Yeah, this is at Camp Evans.
Okay, do you know the approximate date of this?
Nope, I'm sure that it was probably about the middle of March at least. But like I said, unlike those movies, like Platoon or the John Wayne Rainbow Race, where at night they show all of the shooting and fighting. Yeah, like I said, I was very hesitant on shooting those at the people that were running around me because I was afraid that some of them, which some of them were our own American guys.
Sure.
You know? There were some other people running, and you had to be very sure to be for myself to be sure that I was shooting at an NVA instead of one of our own troopers.
Right.
Right. And when it's dark and black, and the only light would be these occasional flares that they would shoot up, you know, and give us a little bit of light for a time, but you would see all these tracers, green and which are theirs, and our yellow flying all over the place, and hearing the bullets zing zing by your ear and everything. So, you know, it was kind of a bit hairy, but it seemed that they blew up our water trucks, and so we had to hang on to our water canteens and our water cans that we had for at least 2 days before another convoy came up to bring us some more water. And I remember that part, but that's the way how it was. And then toward the end of March, that's when I rotated on home.
Okay, now that we've got you through the action of your 1 year tour there, when you were leaving in March of 1968, headed back stateside, what kind of reflections, if any, did you have on leaving Vietnam?
Okay, well, before I answer, before I left Vietnam, you know, since I was a flight engineer, and I was E5 under 2 years, you know, they offered me that if I would extend my tour by 6 months, I would hit my two-year mark, and then they would give me a specialist six, an E6 stripe, if I would remain, if I would stay for another 6 months.
Were you tempted?
I was tempted, but I turned it down because after being knocked down those 3 times in 3 months,
right,
I felt like I was running out of luck. So thank you, but I'm going to go home as an E5. And I got word that I was going to be going to Fort Benning, Georgia. So I decided to go ahead on home and take my 30-day leave at home and then go on to Fort Benning. But I was glad that I went to Vietnam because that's what I volunteered for when I joined the Army. And I did my duty, and I guess I did it well that I went up from E3 to E5 in 9 months, you know, when I got there in Vietnam, and I saw things which I hope I never would see again. But
sure.
But I did things and I saw things and the smell of war that, you know, it's a very unique environment, that I hope I never get involved again. But I told myself, you know, when I leave Vietnam, I still have about 15 months left in the Army. So if the Army wants to send me back here, I will. Unlike my volunteer to go there the first time. So if the Army wanted to send me back the second time, well, that's their business. I would go ahead. But I know what the shooting war is all about, and I did my time, and so I'm glad that I put in my time.
What do you learn about yourself, Mr. Alvarez, as a result of your experiences there?
Okay, well, as a form for myself, I guess you could say I became a bit more religious.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say this is because, you know, when I was a kid, you know, growing up as a Catholic, going to catechism classes during the summer, and then going to Sunday Mass, you know, I thought that, you know, that this was getting bored, you know, and I really didn't take my religion that great, you know. My money, which I was given so I could put into the passing in a basket, you know, that I mostly kept for myself and would stop on by at the drugstore afterwards and buy an ice cream. Right. But then when I got to Fort Benning, Georgia, I looked at church to, you know, at least getting away from those drill sergeants at least for an hour or two. Then when I was at Fort Eustis, you know, I started to kind of change that, you know, that I'm away from my family and friends, and so I only pray to God as a friend and as a savior. And then when I got to Vietnam, you know, there was no such thing as praying in the foxhole, but praying there in the aircraft, you know, that everything would go right. So I guess I became more religious, and I took my faith much more seriously then, and much more honestly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I also learned, you know, to accept life and death. You know that, sure. Well, you know what? When we think of life, you know, we're going to live to be an old man. But sometimes, seeing the young troopers there with their broken bodies, you know, you can also be a young person and not be around. So I just learned to accept life and death and become more religious. But I also accepted things of what I wanted to do in life and to do it well. So, like I said, I came here to San Antonio for about 3 weeks, and I was here for the opening of Hemisphere. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't.
Okay, Hemisphere. That was like a World's Fair here in San Antonio.
Okay.
And they opened it up in April. I was just home about a week, and so I got to see this Hemisphere when they opened up and everything. But then I went to Fort Benning, Georgia, and there at Fort Benning, Georgia, like I said, I got a message there from the Army that, you know, if I wanted to go back to the walk program, that I could take that physical again because they had lowered the standards on the eyesight part.
Right.
So they will still accept my written exams and the rest of my physical and everything. But by that time, I was an NCO, an E5, and I kind of like that position there at Fort Benning, because if I became a warrant officer candidate, that would be more like being basic training where you have to go through all these inspections and everything. But being there at Fort Benning and being a junior NCO, I discovered that officers and NCOs, you know, whenever it came to mess hall time at lunch line, you know, you didn't have to wait in line. You just walk right through line. You know, because it seemed that the Army at that time considered that being an officer or an NCO, that your time was too precious to be wasted and waiting in lines. Not only that, but they're like in the mess hall. There's a certain corner where the officers aid, another corner where a sergeant's aid, and the rest was for the general privates and spec boards and down. And I like kind of eating there with the NCOs because there, I remember being on KP that I would like to be a dining room orderly where you would be standing by the officers or the sergeants, and if they wanted more milk or tea or butter or bread, you know, they would call you and you would go get it. So that was a lot simpler than washing pots and pans. Right, and so I like being an NCO, and like I said, and I'm not too sure if I mentioned it to you, but I made a choice. No, I'm not going to be an Army pilot, but I'm going to join the flying club and get a civilian licensed pilot, and that's what I did.
Okay, well, when did you leave the Army? When did you leave the service?
Okay, well, like I said, I was in the Army, on the regular Army, until June of 69.
Okay.
So I was there at Fort Benning for about 4 months. And there at Fort Benning, I got my licensed pilot. I also found, hey, you're from Texas. Do you ride horses? No, I don't. So I joined the Ride and Hunt Club and learned to ride horses.
Oh, is that right?
That's right. And since my brother and a lot of my friends had gone on to college, there at Fort Benning, they had American University branch. So I went to a couple of semesters and picked up, this was at night, and picked up, you know, a few semester hours. So when I went to college after the Army, you know, I had this under my belt.
Okay, when you left the Army in the summer of 1969, what were your plans? What did you hope to do with your future?
Okay, well, when I left Fort Benning after a year, and there at Fort Benning, I already told you what I did, plus also bought my first vehicle, which was a motorcycle, an Italian Ducati. I bought my first car, which was a four-year-old Buick Riviera. That was my first car. So but I went home, and when I was home on leave after Vietnam, my high school teacher told me that at Our Lady of the Lake College, along with Incarnate Word College, which were all girls' Catholic colleges, they were to become co-ed at the undergraduate level. So listening to my brother, how some of his classes there at UT in Austin, you know, they had, you know, a couple of hundred. I wanted the smaller classes.
Sure.
I had been out of high school for a number of years, not for the 3 years. So I signed up and got accepted to Our Lady of the Lake College, which was an all-girls Catholic college. And that's where I was at. I started classes there in August of 69. The classes were small, like around 20 persons. Many times I was the only guy in the classroom, so I would be sure to read all of my lessons and plans, so this way about could answer right. Right. And I told myself, you know, unlike some of these fewer guys that were there that were working part-time and everything, I'm going to just concentrate, live off of my savings, which I saved up most of my money, I just lived with my parents only for the first few months. I decided, hey, you know, I'm an NCO, but I want to be on my own. So I lived in this garage apartment, you know, close by the college. So I went full-time carrying a full load every big semester. And during the summer, each summer session, I would carry a full load of 6 hours and 6 hours. And one summer, I carried a correspondence course from UT, so I could put it in my general electives. So that one summer I picked up 15 hours. So I got my degree in 3 years.
What was your degree in?
Okay, I first got a BA in sociology with a minor in social welfare, which is what they now call social work.
Sure.
And so that was my degree in. And like I said, I got it in August of 72. And I started working at the San Antonio State Hospital in January of 73 when I was 24, and I stayed there for 27 and a half years.
Wow.
Right, that's why I retired during the summer of the year 2000.
Okay. Now, you also went on for a master's degree, isn't that correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I got my bachelor's degree, since I had a year left of my GI Bill, I started going to this graduate school of your master's degree program in social work, which was a two-year program. And I found out through Uncle Sam, after I used up my 1 year, that if you're going to graduate school, that Uncle Sam would throw in an extra year for graduate school. So I got my master's under the GI Bill again, and so I got both of my degrees under the GI Bill.
Now, is this again at Our Lady of the Lake?
Yes, at Our Lady of the Lake, because at that time in the late in the 70s, and there's only two schools of social work in the whole state of Texas. One was UT there in Austin, mm-hmm. and the other one was right there at Petaluma Lake. But it's not like today where many of your colleges have at least a bachelor's program in social work.
Sure.
Back then it was much more limited, and like I said, and it was a two-year program, a 56-hour program to get a master's.
All right, now, sometime along there, you also got married, is that correct?
Yes, I got married during the last semester of my senior year. I got married, and this was my first marriage, mm-hmm. which was in December of 71. Right. First, I told my fiance, well, no, she was my, I guess you could say my college sweetheart, that let's get married after we both graduate and after we have our first jobs. But then after a while, hey, let's get married right after graduation. And then I told her, hey, you know what, I'm going to be a senior, but I know that we all started together, but I kind of outpaced everyone else, so let's get married in December of 71, so in case if you get, you know, pregnant, I expect to graduate in August of 72, in 8 months, so, you know, I should get my first job right away. So, but no, that's why I got married in December of 71.
Okay. Now, how many children did you have in that marriage?
Four.
Four children?
Yeah, four children, and, you know, they all grown up, and they all done quite well.
Terrific.
You know, like my first two girls, you know, they were valedictorians, and they at the Catholic high school here in San Antonio, and one of them went to UT in Austin, mm-hmm. Chemical engineering. The other one was valedictorian of class of 92, and she went on to Notre Dame of civil engineering. And then my oldest boy, the high school class of 99, he went on to North Texas State, also in civil engineering, and got his degree in 03. But the number four boy, the number four kid, you know, he just went to college only 1 year, and he wanted to write books and live with a girlfriend and move on out to Wisconsin.
Well, they've got to figure those things out on their own.
Yeah, 3 out of 4 isn't bad. And like I said, since they all went into engineering, it seemed that I didn't have to worry about about loans or anything, because they just got scholarships and grants.
That's terrific.
Right, because when you go into engineering, I guess there's not that many engineers, so there's a lot of money for those young students that want to go into that field, and if they can do it.
I'm glad they were able to take advantage of that.
Right.
Now, there are a few questions on the questionnaire that you filled out quite a while ago, and I'd like to bring up a few of them. You've mentioned that you'd like to talk about some of these other issues, so I'll just kind of go down the list here.
Sure.
The first one that you've mentioned that you'd like to talk about had to do with a question regarding the Vietnam War Memorial, the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been to Washington, D.C. and seen the wall?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, it's impressive, you know, especially having all of the names of all the people that have died there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there twice, and I'm quite impressed with it. Yeah, as a matter of fact, when I even donated money toward it when they were first building that,
mm-hmm.
put on that memorial.
Now, this is something that I've seen a few times, and I'm not a Vietnam veteran, of course, but it is certainly, to me, a very moving experience to visit the wall and to see the names and everything that it represents. What about you?
Well, yes, especially when, like that kid that behind me that got killed and many others, you know, I went and, you know, they have a place where you can find out where their names are at, so
mm-hmm.
you can go and make the copies of their name with a piece of paper and
right.
crayons. And so if I did that the first time, and decided to go ahead and keep that for memory's sake. So I know that some people are more sensitive and more emotional than others. You know,
mm-hmm.
I thought myself I'm not that emotional or sensitive until just lately. After these 4 years, I have become more emotional due to an operation which I had in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm glad that we to have that memorial that went up.
Sure. Another question that you mentioned you'd like to speak at somewhat more length on was about the goals and aims of the United States in Vietnam and the cost of trying to attain these goals. Mm-hmm. What is your opinion of that? Do you believe that the sacrifices were worth what the United States gained?
Well, I am glad that, you know, we did put our effort in trying to keep that country, you know what, free and liberated. And it seemed that, you know, and our government really, really let us on down. So I am a bit, you know, depressed on that part, because we did something that we just repeated again. Because if you will remember your history, right after the Second War, you know, World War II,
mm-hmm.
you know, we refused to help out, you know, Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist government there in China, because after the war, you know, there in China, the nationalists and the communists under Mao Tse-tung, they were fighting each other. So when the war ended and they were no longer fighting Japs, they started at each other's throats.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that Mao Tse-tung was getting all of his weapons from Russia, while we, since the United States was tired of fighting the Second War, we did not give any more aid to the nationalist Chinese. So that's why they retreated, and they had that big island called Formosa, which now they call Taiwan,
right,
where they established their national government. So they're still there. But there in South Vietnam, when we pulled out and we signed that peace treaty in January of 73,
mm-hmm.
under Nixon, you know, we were supposed to have been helping out the South Vietnam government and military with their equipment and their finances. And I guess our government, you know, we were tired of spending all that money in that war that we didn't win, that we pulled out. So we didn't give those people any more help at all. So in 2 years, when the North had all of these materials and equipment from Red China and Russia, they were able to go down there in April of 75 and push the South Vietnamese out, because their air force, there was only about one-third of their air force was flying, because the other two-thirds were down due to lack of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Their military might, regarding their tanks and all of their mobile jeeps and trucks and everything, already more than half of it was already not running because of due to lack of parts or whatnot, and that was because our government was not sending them any more equipment or even financial help. That's why that government fell down. And of course, you know, once the North invaded the South, you know, we weren't going to involve our B-52s that could just bomb them on out. No, what? So I'm a bit depressed that our government really didn't help out those people when they needed us again.
So what I hear you saying is that you believe that we did not live up to our commitments to the
That's
South
right.
Vietnamese government.
We did not, you know. And of course, you know, it's not just the individual persons, but it's, you know, you have to take in the wars are fought by nations, and the nations are governed by their own political structure.
Mm-hmm.
In our country, it's Congress, you know, your senators and your House of Representatives. I guess, you know, they've had enough of a war during those long years in Vietnam that really nothing was accomplished, according to them, that, you know, that they no longer needed our help. So that's why we didn't help out the South Vietnamese people, seeing that we kind of screwed them. So whenever I see them here in the States, you know, I only wish we could have helped them out more.
Sure. Well, what do you think about U.S. military intervention in other countries, including Vietnam, but since Vietnam as well? What's your opinion of the way we've handled these things?
Since Vietnam, okay. Well, I know that we have sent our troopers into these minor skirmish areas. Well, the biggest one, you know, before the war over there that's going on right now would be, like in Panama, where
mm-hmm.
we got Noriega, and before that there was some Granada, you know, some little island out there.
Sure.
And I'm sure there was one or two other ones that were minor. So, you know, but I mean, if we have to do something, you know, in order to protect our citizens in those little countries, well, then I can see that, you know. But this war that we have presently on, you know, this President Bush should have done what his father did in that first one back in 91, is just, you know, destroy military forces of the enemy, but don't go into the country. Mm-hmm. And this one did, with some type of fantasy land which you're going to, you know, create the democracy within a few years, because that's not humanly possible, because humans, it takes a long time depending upon where you grew up at, you know, what type of environment and society you grew up in for hundreds of years. You're not going to change it overnight.
Sure, sure. Well, I have another question for you regarding the U.S. and Vietnam. We covered your experiences, I think, pretty well. But what about the way the American public in general reacted to the war in Vietnam? You were over there at obviously a watershed time in the war. When you got home, what did you perceive about the American public's view of the war, and do you think it had any effect on the way the war was conducted?
Okay. Well, when I first went to Vietnam, it seemed that a lot of the public was kind of for it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in high school, you know, we even had a book drive, you know, where we would collect paperbacks so we could send big boxes of paperbacks to the troopers over there in Vietnam. I myself, I even got to read a lot of paperbacks when I was out there, because that's the only bit of entertainment which I had. So it seemed that the public was more for it back then, which was in the early years, like 64, 65, and 66 when I went in. But when I came back, it seemed that a lot of people no longer wanted for us to be there. They were turned off, I guess, by the American debt that was just flowing on in. And of course, you know, with our TVs, and they always show the American troopers that had been wounded or killed, you know, on the newsreels, on the 5 o'clock news every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that turned off a lot of people.
Sure. All right, well, I think we've covered things pretty well here today, Mr. Alvarez. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview before we bring it to a close?
I guess that's it.
All right, well, terrific. We'll go ahead and end this interview officially with Alfred Alvarez. Mr. Alvarez, hang on just a minute. I'll turn off the recording equipment, and I'll chat with you for a little bit longer,
yes,
okay?
Yes, because I want to chat with you, too.
Okay.